From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mary Jane Meeker and Patricia Highsmith had each written popular lesbian novels under pen names when they met in the mid-1950s in a Greenwich Village bar. Their romance lasted 2 years. On today's Fresh Air, Mary Jane Meeker talks about her affair with Highsmith, who wrote the classic novels Strangers on a Train and The Talented Mr. Ripley. Meeker is also known by her pen names, Vin Packer, Ann Aldrich, and M.E. Kerr. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Mortals, the new novel by Norman Rush. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Attackers killed an American soldier and wounded two others today in Iraq, hitting the ambulance they rode in with a rocket-propelled grenade. Earlier, a mortar attack killed one Iraqi and wounded a dozen outside a humanitarian aid office run by the Allies in a town north of Baghdad. NPR's Deborah Amos says they're the latest in a series of attacks aimed at Americans and Iraqis who support them.
The pattern has been going on for weeks, and U.S. military officials have been saying that these are organized attacks, guerrilla attacks. They say it's from the remnants of Saddam Hussein's regime, some from Islamic fighters, and they acknowledge some from disgruntled Iraqis who do not like the occupation, who are trained, who have weapons, and who attack them. Pockets, yes, organized, no, but it is from all over the country.
NPR's Deborah Amos in Baghdad. The Air Force has dropped manslaughter and assault charges against two National Guard pilots who killed four Canadian soldiers in a mistaken bombing last year in Afghanistan. Majors Harry Schmidt and William Umbach will not be court-martialed. Claire Leger, the mother of one of the Canadian soldiers who was killed, said she's disappointed with the Air Force decision.
I don't accept that he can still fly over innocent soldiers. Like, they're so... The top guns are so special, but what about the poor unpaid soldier beneath them?
The two pilots, they said they believed the Canadians were enemy fighters who were shooting at them. An Air Force general said commanders should decide whether Schmidt, who dropped a 500-pound bomb on the Canadian unit, should be punished for failing to obey an air controller's order to hold his fire. President Bush was on the road in Minnesota today promoting his economic policies on the same day that the Treasury Department released figures showing a record deficit for the year so far. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The latest figures show that the federal deficit for the first 8 months of budget year 2003 is $292.1 billion. That partial year figure tops the previous full year record deficit of $290 billion from 1992. The White House blames the return of deficits on the recession and the costs of war and fighting terrorism. Democrats put the blame on the tax cuts the Bush administration has won. The president, in his speech outside Minneapolis, said the tax cuts will get the economy growing again, which he predicts will actually increase revenues. Critics of the president's economic policies say the cuts primarily benefit the wealthiest Americans and argue that the tax cuts will have little immediate effect on an economy which has lost 3 million private sector jobs since Mr. Bush took office. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 114 points to close at 91.79 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 28 points to close at 16.48. This is NPR News. Authorities in Benton Harbor are hoping for another peaceful night, but police are prepared for violence. Hundreds rioted in the West Michigan town earlier this week, angry over the death of a black motorcyclist who crashed while fleeing a white police officer. NPR's David Shaper reports.
In addition to a police presence that included a state police helicopter and small armored vehicles, authorities were aided last night by a heavy rain in keeping anyone who had thoughts of rioting indoors. With no rain in the forecast, Benton Harbor Police Chief Samuel Harris says tonight will be a true test of whether other efforts to defuse violence in the community are working. Those efforts include community meetings, peace marches led by ministers, and a meeting with Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm in a Benton Harbor church. But Chief Harris says he fears the growing media spotlight on Benton Harbor and possible visits by the likes of presidential candidate Al Sharpton and the Reverend Jesse Jackson will escalate the rhetoric and possibly incite some residents looking for attention. David Schaefer, NPR News, Benton Harbor, Michigan.
The Justice Department says an Ohio truck driver has pleaded guilty to felony charges of supporting terrorists and conspiracy. The plea agreement with Iman Ferris was reached about 6 weeks ago, but the documents weren't unsealed until today. Ferris, a naturalized American who was born in Kashmir, allegedly helped the Al-Qaeda terrorist organization scout locations for potential terrorist attacks. The government says Al-Qaeda agents instructed Ferris to obtain equipment for cutting bridge cables and derailing trains. None of the attacks were carried out. Prosecutors say Ferris met with senior Al-Qaeda leaders in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Keen, helping clients manage business performance through business consulting, application development and integration, and application outsourcing. Keen, we get IT done.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mary Jane Meeker, holds an important place in the history of paperback books and gay literature. Her 1952 novel, Spring Fire, was one of the first paperback originals to deal with a lesbian theme. It sold about 1.5 million copies. Its success led to the publication of many more lesbian-themed paperbacks, including more by Meeker. She wrote her early lesbian novels under the pen name Vin Packer. She wrote lesbian-themed nonfiction books under another pseudonym, Ann Aldrich. Now she writes fiction for young adults under the pen name M.E. Kerr. Meeker has a new memoir about her two-year affair in the 1950s with Patricia Highsmith, who also used a pen name, Claire Morgan, to write her 1953 lesbian novel, The Price of Salt. Highsmith, who died in 1995, is best known as the author of Strangers on a Train, which was adapted into an Alfred Hitchcock film, and The Talented Mr. Ripley, which is adapted into a recent film starring Matt Damon. Mary Jane Meeker's memoir, Highsmith, A Romance of the 1950s, is not only about her relationship with Highsmith, it's about lesbian culture of the 1950s. Here's a reading from the opening of the book.
Els was on a little side street in Greenwich Village, a dark, cozy lesbian bar. It was the beginning of graciousness in the lesbian bar world. There was no evidence of mafia ownership, no men in baggy, double-breasted suits, sporting pinky rings, guarding the door. In fact, no men were allowed. The bathroom was clean. The customers didn't seem to be divided so much into butch and femme. Most looked like young college girls, well-dressed, and without the heavy makeup some habitués wore. Hookers were often regular customers of gay bars. Their butches waited for them there. But there was none of that in Els. The women behind the bar and at the door were welcoming. The music was mellow, Jerry Southern singing You Better Go Now, and Frances Faye crooning I'm Drunk with Love. A handsome, dark-haired woman in a trench coat, drinking gin, stood at the bar, while around her there was the buzz that she was Claire Morgan. She was better known in the outside world as Patricia Highsmith, author of Strangers on a Train, which had become an Alfred Hitchcock thriller in 1951. But in Els, Pat was revered for her pseudonymous novel, The Price of Salt, which had been published in 1952 by Coward McCann. It was for many years the only lesbian novel in either hard or soft cover with a happy ending. It stood on every lesbian bookshelf, along with classics like The Well of Loneliness, We Two Are Drifting, Diana, and Olivia.
Mary Jane Meeker, what did Patricia Highsmith mean to you before you actually met her at this bar?
Well, in the early 50s, we used to play a game of truth. And I remember one night, the question was, if you could be anyone besides yourself, a living person, who would you choose to be? And I actually said Patricia Highsmith. I loved her writing. I think we shared a common theme, which was folie à deux, sort of simultaneous insanity, two people involved with each other very closely, often in a crime. I think that was and her writing, of course, was what drew me to her before I even knew her.
What was her literary importance?
Well, it wasn't very much then. She had a screen presence. The Strangers on a Train was really what she was known for. And she had done the Ripley book and a few others, but she wasn't a very well-known writer then.
What was her place in the world of gay literature?
Well, The Price of Salt was and is a gay classic, again, because of the happy ending. There just wasn't such a thing. Gay books weren't reviewed. They weren't acknowledged in any magazines like the Saturday Review of Literature or The Atlantic or Harper. And here we have a book that came along with a picture of lesbian life as possible and happy.
Now, you had said that when you played that game of truth, you wanted to be Patricia Highsmith. Now you had a chance to meet her and to get really close to her. How did she compare with what you imagined her to be?
Well, she was everything I imagined her to be. I loved the way she looked. She looked like a combination of Prince Charming and Nureyev. She was very chic, with her trench coat and her collar pulled up, smoking Gauloises and drinking gin straight. She was easy to talk to. I went up and introduced myself and told her that I was a writer. And we began to talk very easily. I think we were also drinkers, and that always facilitates conversation.
You were both popular writers. Who was more out at the time? And were you out in different ways?
I was far more out. I was politically active, and I was interested in the new movement for gay rights and in New York. She was not at all interested in anything like that. She wasn't interested in politics. She really wasn't very interested in any kind of gay identity. So I was, and we had a little... We always disagreed on that point. She would say, we're just... what we do in bed is nobody's business. And I would try to remind her that we were more than horizontal people and that we did have a bit of entitlement. But that didn't interest Pat.
Now, were you and Patricia Highsmith from different literary worlds?
Well, she was, I think, more intellectual than I. She was born to read Shakespeare in her free time, read Chekhov. She read the dictionary every single night. That doesn't make her intellectual, but it's odd. She was more of a loner, too, in her strange way, because she traveled a lot alone. When she was home, when she was in New York, she was very extroverted, and she liked seeing people. But a lot of the time, she chose to be alone and to travel alone, and I think she read a lot. So, and also, must remember that when I met Pat, Pat was published in hardcover. She was never a softcover writer. And I was, at the time I met her, a paperback writer. So that was a great difference in us.
What were some of the good parts and bad parts about being lovers with one of the few published lesbian novelists? You were both lesbian novelists.
Yes.
Both written books about lesbians. It was a pretty small world back in the 50s. So, you know, on the one hand, you could share thoughts. On the other hand, you didn't want to step on each other's toes. So what were some of the ups and downs about being part of that same small world?
Well, we were never competitive. I don't think so. She wrote only one book, and she wrote it under a pseudonym, which was very unlike her. I, on the other hand, always used pseudonyms and still do. And so we didn't compete too much. Friends didn't even know who I was in many cases because I had so many different names. And then the only time that we probably competed was in reviewing the mystery column in the Sunday New York Times. Always had hardcover books along with paperbacks in the same column. I think she didn't like that very much. I think she felt she deserved more space.
At some point, you realized that, among other things, Patricia Highsmith was anti-Semitic and racist. You quote her as having said to you, "You live in New York, that makes you a Jew lover. Where I live, we don't take to them. I don't know any Swiss or French or anyone where I live who's sympathetic to Jews. On the contrary." How did you deal with remarks like that?
Okay, that was the older Pat. You must remember that when I was with Pat, I wouldn't have been able to stand that kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't that kind of person then. She would occasionally say Negro in a funny way because she knew that I didn't like her to say nigger, which she sometimes said. She was from Texas, and her mother talked that way, and she was sometimes unguarded. But she was never anti-Semitic that I knew her. When I was with her, when she came back, the part you just quoted happened 27 years later.
Right.
When we hadn't been in touch for 27 years, and she got in touch with me, and we began to write, and she came for a visit. And the very first thing she said, told me she was hungry, and she said that she would love a sandwich, and I was making her one, and she said, and she had just come through the door, she said, remember the wonderful ham sandwiches we used to get in first class on planes? You can't get them anymore. And I said, why not? And with her finger, she made a crooked nose. And then she said, I guess it's the Yids. And then I knew I was in big trouble because she was staying with me for 3 days, and I couldn't believe what was coming out of her mouth.
So she became anti-Semitic later in life. Years earlier, when you were together, how did you end up splitting up?
Well, first I want to say that I'm sure there were seeds of the anti-Semitism there because she had had a book rejected by an editor at HarperCollins that she really revered. And so she blamed it on the Jewish establishment, the publishing establishment in New York, that were against her somehow. She did mention that when I knew her, that she was convinced there was a Jewish establishment, almost a mafia, that didn't like her. So there were the seeds of it there. It was never a part of our breaking up, or it was never at all an issue with us, the anti-Semitism, because it didn't exist then that I knew of. We broke up because I always say it was wine in winter. We were in Pennsylvania. We were in Bucks County. It was the worst winter I could ever imagine. The snow was up to the windows. And we were wine lovers. And I think the combination, she was very eager to go and live in Europe. We'd made a pact that she would try 2 years in the country with me. And if it didn't work, then I'd try Europe. But this was already 3 or 4 months into our 2-year lease. And she was, every time she drank wine, which was a lot, she began to talk about Europe and how she wished she was there. And I always felt that I was keeping her from something. I didn't want to live in Europe because I would be deaf and dumb there. I wasn't very good at languages. I just found a foothold in New York in publishing. I just found one of those wonderful professional apartments that are so rare and so hard to get. And I was always feeling I was in her way, though she didn't want to go to Europe without me. And I think that a lot of it, too, was the rejection of that novel that made that winter unbearable for her. When a novel's rejected, usually your editor encourages you to do some rewrite. You try to salvage the novel. But there was no such action taken on the part of her editor at Harper and Row. And I think it just crushed her. And so I think that contributed to a very bad mood she had. And then, of course, she began to drink in the daytime, and that scared me.
All right. Well, you know, you had your wish come true, meeting a person who you admired and loved from afar and then actually having a relationship with them, and after a couple of years it didn't work.
Yes, that's for sure. And the strangest part to me was that that she ever wrote me again after so many years. I can't imagine what that was about. And she wrote me with a very flimsy excuse asking if I had some family papers of hers. I not only didn't have them, I didn't even know her family, which had just been her mother, had any papers. So I think it was an excuse to get in touch. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why. And I, even when she came to visit, I didn't know why. I was, of course, so aggrieved at her awful anti-Semitism, and it wasn't just that. She was anti-black. She was anti-everybody, and it wasn't easy to entertain her or to like her. It was a puzzling 3 days. I never knew why she had come. I was the only one she came to see. She told me she thought it was going to be her last visit to the States. She told me, too, that she had cancer. So that made it very hard for me to dislike her. I wanted to dislike everything she was saying, and then I felt sorry for her because she had cancer. And she, I could tell she was afraid that she might be going to die.
Do you feel like you're betraying her at all in writing about these things?
No, I don't. Pat would always say, "You're right or right." That's what I do, and it's what I've done all my life. I might have felt it if I had come out of the woodwork and written one book. But my life has been writing, and this was the greatest challenge that I could imagine. For one thing, I wanted to tell the story of gay people. Our stories aren't told. And I had been working on a memoir even before Pat's visit. But when Pat came, I suddenly realized I would have to try and sort out in my mind how besotted I was with her in the 50s and how very much I disliked her in the 90s. And I often work things out. Of course, the only way I do work things out is writing. So that's how Highsmith came about.
My guest is Mary Jane Meeker. Her new memoir is called Highsmith. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. My guest is Mary Jane Meeker, and her new memoir, Highsmith, is about her 2-year romance with the novelist Patricia Highsmith, whose books include The Talented Mr. Ripley and Strangers on a Train, which is adapted into the now classic Alfred Hitchcock movie. Highsmith also wrote a lesbian novel under a pen name. And of course, my guest, Mary Jane Meeker, has written many, many novels, most of them under pen names of one sort or another, yes. And many of them lesbian novels as well. Let's talk more about your life. First of all, when you realized that it was girls, not boys, that you were attracted to, had you ever heard the word lesbian or heard that there was such a thing?
Oh, yes. I went to boarding school deliberately because I wanted to find out about this world that I knew I was part of. And I had read that boarding schools were filled with perversion. So I was very eager to go to boarding school, and I was rewarded, indeed, boarding school.
I'm sure you didn't tell your parents, "Hey, I've heard that there's a lesbian underground in the boarding school."
No, and I must say, to save the school's reputation, that I seemed to be the only one that stayed at the dance in my class, because I notice everybody else is married and has children and has settled down to the straight life. But no, I read everything I could find. The minute I knew things were wrong with me, I read everything that I could find. Then, after boarding school, when I chose college, I chose deliberately a co-ed college because I thought maybe I should cure myself. The one thing I didn't know in all my readings and studyings about lesbianism was that there isn't a cure. In those days, it was considered an illness, and you were led to believe it could be cured.
Now, you were among the first lesbian pulp novelists. You wrote for Gold Medal, which is famous, among other things, for first publishing original paperbacks. In other words, these were books that were never in hardcover. And most
That's
of these
right.
were pulp novels. They were, you know, crime novels and sex-oriented novels.
Mm-hmm.
How did you end up writing lesbian pulp fiction for Gold Medal?
Well, first of all, pulp isn't really, I know everybody calls it pulp. I call it paperback. Pulp, to me, were the pulp, wonderful pulp magazines that paid a penny a word.
Sure, yeah.
And that was pulp.
Right.
But now it's become pulp. You must remember that these paperback writers were very well paid, far better paid than you would be in hardcover. And so you had writers like John McDonald, Day Keen, some wonderful Theodore Pratt, Charles Williams. They were wonderful writers. They wrote everything from westerns to mysteries. And there was nothing racy, really, about the gold medal line, except they did start writing lesbian novels, thanks to the book I wrote called Spring Fire, which, strangely enough, outsold God's Little Acre in paperback
the year
that it was published. No one had ever had lesbian novels out there. And, of course, on the cover of Spring Fire, they have a story once told in whispers, now frankly, honestly written. And so this book became, they were amazed at the mail they got. They couldn't believe it. It came by the boxfuls, some of it from men, but most of it from women. And so then they knew they had something.
How did you write Spring Fire, your first lesbian paperback?
I became friendly with the editor, Dick Carroll. And he said, if you had a story to write, what would you write about? And I said, well, I just came from college, and before that I was in boarding school, and I had a lesbian experience in boarding school, and I think I would write about that and how I tried to get rid of it in college. And he said, oh, that's a wonderful idea, but make it college, because he said, grade school people don't read our books. Make it college. And so then I wrote Spring Fire. He called it Spring Fire because James Michener had a novel out called The Fires of Spring. And Dick thought, maybe people will confuse this with Michener and we'll have double the sales. Because nobody really thought a book about lesbians was going to sell anything.
You sold 1.5 million copies, if what I read
yes.
is correct.
Many, many, yes. It went into many, many reprints.
Mary Jane Meeker, her new memoir is called Highsmith, A Romance of the 1950s. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You better go now, because I like you much too much. You have a way with you. You ought to know now just why I like you very much. The night was gay with you. There's a moon above, and it gives my heart a lot of sway. Spring, I want you so now. You have the lips I love to touch.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, lesbian pulp fiction. We talk with Mary Jane Meeker about writing lesbian novels in the 1950s under the pen name Vin Packer. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Mortals, the new novel by Norman Rush. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mary Jane Meeker. Her new memoir, Highsmith, A Romance of the 1950s, is about her two-year romance with the writer Patricia Highsmith. Highsmith wrote the classic novels Strangers on a Train and The Talented Mr. Ripley, which were adapted into films. Mary Jane Meeker helped start the genre of lesbian pulp fiction with the novels she wrote in the 50s under the pen name Vin Packer. They were published by Gold Medal Books, which pioneered the paperback original. Meeker's first Vin Packer novel, Spring Fire, was published in 1952 and sold 1.5 million copies. Now, one of the things your editor told you at Gold Medal was that you had to have a happy ending to this lesbian novel. Why did you need that?
Yes, because these paperbacks went through the mail, and the mail censored things. And if there was anything that seemed to proselytize for a vice like lesbianism, why, then they would junk the whole shipment. Everybody's books would go down with yours because they couldn't bother to unpack and find your books. So we had to have happy endings if we were writing about, quote, perversion, unquote. And so that was what I did with Spring Fire. And the the unhappy endings were hilarious. I mean, I look at them, I can't believe I wrote them.
But, well, in fact, you brought one of your novels with you. The first one, Spring Fire.
Mm-hmm.
Can you read the happy ending for us?
Here's the happy ending. She's just left her psychoanalyst or psychiatrist's office, Susan, and he is saying, Dr. Peters lingered in the hall near the door as Susan Mitchell buttoned her coat and put her scarf around her head. "Then I'll see you on Tuesday," he said, taking her hand in a friendly goodbye. "And have a nice weekend, Susan. Any big plans?" "I'm going on a hayride tonight. Robin and Tom and Lucifer and me. That's about all I planned." He let her hand go and smiled as he held the door open. "It sounds like fun," he answered. "Bye, Susan." It was cold, and there was a warning of snow in the fresh sweep of the breeze as Mitch walked along the path from the hospital. She had a clean feeling that was there whenever she finished talking with Dr. Peters, and she knew she was whole now. The tower bell struck 5 times, and distant figures of students carrying books hurried along the far walks, their breaths frosting faintly in the cold air. When she went by the auditorium, she could hear the university choir rehearsing for the Christmas pageant, and the nostalgic strains drifted out to her. Dusk was dressing the campus, and as Mitch walked with the music in her heart, she thought of Lita, hazily, as though she were someone she had known a long, long time ago. She knew that if it had been any other way, if Lita Taylor could have been helped and could have at that moment walked there too, and known the peace in the twilight and the first hints of frost on the grass and the bushes surrounding Cranston, Mitch would have wanted that, because it was true what she had told Lita yesterday. She didn't hate her. She didn't hate her at all, and she knew then that she had never really loved her.
So she has a kind of like heterosexual awakening at the end?
Oh, she goes to a doctor, and he turns her into a heterosexual. That's why she says she's going off with these wonderful straight couples for fun that weekend. Yes. And she realizes not only is she a heterosexual, but she never really was a homosexual.
Right. So this made it safe to travel through the mails. How did you feel when you were writing this phony ending?
I laughed. I was not politically conscious to that point. It really hadn't begun yet. I wrote this, I think it was 51 or 52. I was right out of college, and I thought it was a funny idea. You don't have any, when you're writing these things, you don't have any vision of the future, of their even being there or discussed in the future. It was, I was delighted to get my first book published, and if that was the rule, well, I was willing to follow it.
Okay, now we're talking about the kind of happy ending you had to paste onto your novel so that it wouldn't be censored in the mail. A subsequent novel that you wrote, also a lesbian novel, called Whisper His Sin. I'm sorry, I guess this is a homosexual novel.
Yes. That was actually based on a true murder case, the Fraiden-Wetman murder case. Two young men murdered one of their mothers. And I just copied that. I created that book from the news stories. I made it fiction. These titles were never my titles either.
Whisper His Sin.
Yes.
But the cover copy, for what was written on the cover of this book was, "This is one of the most shocking novels we have ever published. It deals with a strange way of life that has become all too prevalent and is still spreading. The book begins in the tormented mind of a boy and ends in the tormented murder of his parents. Between this beginning and this end, there is a frightening picture of how the blight of sexual distortion spreads, corrupts, and finally destroys those around it. We also believe that this is one of the most morally enlightening books you will ever read." Was it important in terms of censorship to put all this morally enlightening stuff on the cover?
Yes, that was all part of it. I think gay people felt, because we didn't have a sense of entitlement in the 50s, but we felt there are books about us. Even a book about a criminal case like Fraiden and Wetman, which was a rather astounding case, we were suddenly there. We hadn't been there before all of this. We didn't exist. And even if there were a few books about us, they were never reviewed. They were never put out in the bookstore or the window. You had to somehow find about them in an underground way. So as we became more open, yes, we had these cautionary blurbs that our publishers wrote, but still it was more important to have us there. And that case, then Anthony Bosher, who was the Sunday Times mystery reviewer, then called to my attention a famous case in New Zealand of two girls who murdered their mother. And I then did the same thing with that case, and I became very interested in turning real-life cases into fiction.
The story of that case was also adapted into the film Beautiful Creatures, and one of the girls in that story later wrote novels under the pen name Anne Perry, many best-selling novels.
Yes, I think she considers that her real name. She was Pauline Parker was her real name, and when she was... when she murdered with her friend, her friend's mother, she was an intriguing character. She was my favorite of the two girls. She was rewriting the Bible, and she had a graveyard where she buried dead ideas, and she was very imaginative. And it wasn't until many, many years later that I found out, and everybody did at the same time, that she was the very distinguished mystery writer Anne Perry.
Now, the books that we talked about, Whisper His Sin and Spring Fire, were both written under the pen name Vin Packer. Your name is Mary Jane Meeker. Why didn't you use your own name?
Well, I have always had a reluctance to using my own name. Even now, I still don't write under my own name, unless it's something like the Highsmith book, where I would have to, or a book like Shockproof Sydney Skate, which was an adult book about a lesbian and her son falling in love with the same girl. I like pseudonyms. I like disguises. I've always hated the name Mary Jane, and I think the idea that you can name yourself is interesting. That Vin Packer, unfortunately, wasn't a very well thought out name. We were having lunch with a man named Vincent and a woman whose name was Annie Packer. So I put Vin Packer together, never thinking that there would be any life to this name. But there was a considerable life. I did 22 books under that name.
What didn't work about the name?
Well, I just thought it was a silly name. It sounded like a sportscaster. And I don't know. I might have thought more carefully about it if I had thought I was going to be with it that long. Mm-hmm. But I was my own agent. That was another name for the pseudonyms. I had I couldn't get an agent, so I printed stationery up and became an agent. And all of my pseudonyms were me. All of my clients were me. And I would take people out to lunch and tell them about my clients. And nobody knew that I was all my clients.
What was your name as an agent?
Mary Jane Meeker.
Oh, I see.
That was another name for all these pseudonyms. I had many. I had Mamie Stone, who was a confession writer. She and her husband, Edgar Stone, I had made up that they lived in Maine and that they never came into New York. So that the magazines that were buying Edgar Stone and Mamie Stone confessions never anticipated meeting these people. And I always had stories about my clients, why they couldn't come to New York.
So a lot of people really thought that Mary Jane Meeker was an agent. Who?
Oh, yes.
Wow.
Oh, yes. Even my editor, Dick Carroll, thought so in the beginning. He didn't realize when I gave him the Ann Aldrich book, the first Ann Aldrich book.
That's another that pen
it was
name
me.
Of yours, yeah.
Yes, I wanted him to see if he would buy it if it wasn't me. And he didn't know that it was me when I gave him the first book. Ann Aldrich was a journalist. She was me, but she was a journalist who studied the lesbian world and wrote about it in factual way.
My guest is Mary Jane Meeker. Her new memoir is called Highsmith. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Jane Meeker. Her new memoir is called Highsmith. It's about her two-year romance with the writer Patricia Highsmith in the 1950s. During that time, Meeker was writing lesbian novels under the pen name Vin Packer. Did your life have the kind of drama that your writing did?
Well, a writer never has as much drama as a writer writes about, because you're staying home in a little room writing, or a big room if you're lucky, but I was in a little room, and I knew a lot of people. I got to know a lot of people, and I think largely, and particularly in lesbian life, and I think the reason we all knew each other was the only place we could gather were in gay bars. There was absolutely no place you could go. There were no dances. There were no open meetings. There was a group called the Daughters of Bilitis. But they were a very small group, and nobody that I knew wanted to join it. And so we met in bars.
You write really well about gay bars in your new memoir about Patricia Highsmith. And you write how a lot of the gay bars were run by the mafia in the 1950s.
Yes.
What were those bars like?
They were terrible. That you would go in, and at the door there would be a man in a low man on the totem pole in the mafia world. He would usually have a couple of zircons on his little fingers and a double-breasted suit, and he would smoke cigars, and he would watch the door, mainly watch to keep men out. And he was also the one that told you whether you could cash your checks. And if they had a system where they tattooed your wrist when you came in, many did. He was in charge of the tattooing. And they were in all the bars, and these bars were terrible bars. There was a woman that sat outside the ladies' room and gave you one piece of toilet tissue at a time, and you went in single file because they imagined that you would go in there with other women and do terrible things in the ladies' room. And, of course, there were no men in, so there was no men's room. But the ladies' room was always terrible shape. There was always a plunger on the floor somewhere, needed at some point. They just didn't keep them clean. And they took advantage of the fact that you were lucky to have any place to go.
And did the mafia run a lot of these bars because the bars were perceived as being connected to vice?
No, the mafia ran them for money. They knew that they could make a lot of money on it, and they knew they could work in tangent with the police. They paid the police off. The police came around regularly. And if they hadn't been paid, then they claimed that they were breaking the fire rules, or they claimed that there was dope on the premises. And they would take women off in the paddy wagon. They never took you off in the paddy wagon because you were homosexual. It was always under an excuse that they could, that would hold up in court, such as there were too many in the bar, so you were breaking a fire law, or they had seen dope being passed around.
Now, in your new memoir, you say that it was important to have the gay bars segregated by sex, lesbian bars and gay men's bars. You couldn't afford to have men and women together in the same gay bar. Why was that a problem?
Well, there was a problem for several reasons. One is, if you have a bar where men and women mingle, if it's a lesbian bar and they allowed men in, men were always somehow at their worst around lesbians. They were attracted to them. They didn't know how to talk to them. And they were just bizarre, and they were bizarre men who were attracted. We called them fish queens. And there were some that hung outside. Then there were always servicemen that would find somehow, they would ask cab drivers or something, who thought it would be fun to go and watch girls together. And this was always trouble. So whoever ran the bars had to keep men out. And that still holds in a lot of cases. I know I live in the Hamptons, and I haven't ever seen any successful bars out there, and there are gay bars where they mingle, where men and women mingle.
And you say that women could wear slacks in gay bars. Was it difficult to wear slacks to a straight bar or to a fine restaurant?
Well, you in New York, you couldn't. It had nothing to do with whether you were gay or not. You simply couldn't wear pants in restaurants in the 50s. There were some that began to, in the later 50s, allow you in pants, but it simply wasn't a rule. I mean, it was a rule that you couldn't.
In the 1970s, you started writing novels for young adults, and you're still writing novels for young adults. Have
yes.
many of them been gay-themed?
Yes. I did the first novel that was written, young adult or adult, about homosexual young men having AIDS. It was called Night Kites. And I published that in 83 or 84, I can't remember. But when I wrote it, it was earlier, AIDS was called GRID, Gay-Related Immune Deficiency. Nobody knew anything about it. And my book was the first book out there. There was a book about somebody getting AIDS through a blood transfusion, but mine was about homosexual, male homosexual life, and about a young boy whose brother got AIDS, and the family found out that he was dying and that he had that he was homosexual at the same time, which was true of many, many young men.
Have you had any problems with school libraries who didn't want your books on the shelf because
they
were gay-themed?
Yes. I also did a book called Deliver Us from Evie, which is about a lesbian set in Missouri in the farms. And I did another book called Hello, I Lied, which is about a gay boy who falls in love with a girl one summer. He goes back to his boyfriend in the end, but he has a summer love affair with a girl, which is also not an uncommon thing that happens to both men and women. So those were the three books I think that I've done as Emmy Kerr, which have touched on homosexuality.
What are some of the things that happened after Stonewall and after the start of the gay rights movement that have affected your life that you thought you would never see?
Mm-hmm. The main thing I thought I would never see, and if my parents weren't dead, it would kill them, is the announcements in the New York Times, the commitment announcements, mm-hmm. along with the wedding pages. That, to me, is miraculous and wonderful. And I think, to me, it's the thing that gives me the most pleasure. That's one thing. And, of course, so many changes, the freedom among the young people to announce that they're gay. The idea that it's not unusual today for a parent to hear from a child, I'm gay, and to handle it, and for many, many people, even Dr. Phil on television, advising parents how to handle gay children. And you don't seem to hear anymore about going to an analyst to be cured. It doesn't exist anymore. And even the Psychoanalytic Society has finally taken us off the abnormal list. I see progress everywhere, and it's thrilling to me.
Well, Mary Jane Meeker, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mary Jane Meeker's new memoir is called Highsmith, A Romance of the 1950s. Her novels for young adults are written under the pen name M.E. Kerr. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Norman Rush's new novel, Mortals. This is Fresh Air. Norman Rush's long-awaited second novel, Mortals, has just been published. It's an ambitious story about sex, politics, religion, and literature. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says it's a book that contains everything. Well, almost.
Are admiration and a shared history enough? For the disintegrating marriage that Norman Rush portrays in his new novel, Mortals, the answer is no. Ray and Iris Finch are a middle-aged white American couple living in Africa in the 1990s. Ray adores Iris passionately, but he senses that her ardor has cooled, her eyes have strayed. Now let's consider that same question in a different context. Are admiration and a shared history enough? Enough to keep a reader committed to a novel? I think the answer again turns out to be no. I truly admired the grand ambition of Rush's novel, its range of topics and emotional agility, its brilliant literary digressions on everything from the poetry of Gerard Manley Hopkins to the letters of Harry Houdini's mother. And after 700-plus pages, I certainly felt as though I shared a reading history with mortals. But at the end of the whole affair, I had to admit, I just wasn't in love. Mortals, like Rush's first novel, Mating, is set in Botswana, where Ray Finch operates as a CIA agent. His cover is that of an English teacher, a Milton specialist, at an esteemed secondary school. Ray has just turned 48, and he's deep into the age of doubt. His covert work, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union, seems less and less meaningful. When his despicable new boss orders Ray to gather incriminating evidence on a local political figure named Samuel Kerekang, who's guilty of the noble crime of preaching power to the people, Ray rebels. He would much prefer to dig up dirt on Dr. Davis Morrell, a holistic healer who's laid his hands, Ray suspects, on his beautiful younger wife, Iris. Since everything that transpires in this novel is limited to Ray's point of view, Iris and her infidelities remain suspensefully enigmatic until the literally explosive climax of the tale, where Ray, Kerekang, and Morrell find themselves fighting together cheek by jowl in a bloody clash between nationalists and mercenaries in the northern part of Botswana. If such a phenomenon as a screwball massacre can be envisioned, that's just what Rush choreographs in this extended scene, where the truth finally outs. Time for a confession of my own. I haven't read Mortal's predecessor, Mating, which every serious reader I know tells me is stunning, and which won the National Book Award in 1991. But I have read Paradise Lost, which is handy here, not only because Ray is a Milton scholar who relentlessly references the master's epic, but because I think the problem with Mortals is similar to the famous problem with Paradise Lost. As generations of Miltonists have pointed out, God the Father and God the Son in Paradise Lost are flat characters. Glamorous Satan runs away with the poem. He gets the best lines and behaves in unpredictable ways. In Mortals, a weighty novel that, like Paradise Lost, also meditates on questions of insurrection, both personal and cosmic, Ray is akin to Milton's God. He's the good, still center of a turning tumultuous world. Every time Morel, Karakang, Iris, or even the most minor character whizzes by, they steal the show. Take Ray's estranged brother Rex, who corresponds with Iris. Rex, we're told, styles himself as a kind of gay Mencken. Here's Rex in a letter to Iris presenting his theory on contemporary American children. I think people are finding their own children boring, and this is due to two factors. Factor one is that by the time a child normally would be a developed persona, a real individual, he or she has become a kind of playback machine for various media tropes and loops. That is, the child is old television, a rerun. Then factor two comes into play, to wit, that when the parent looks at his boring child, he knows that on television or video, there is bound to be something on that's more interesting than the child before him. Ray offers a lot of wise insights, and he's even funny. But nothing he says in his extended internal monologues comes close to being as unexpected or vivacious as this cast-off commentary of Rex's. No wonder Iris, late in the novel, tells Ray she's wearied of leading such a vacuous, well-behaved life with him. Mortals is structurally dazzling, erudite, and substantial, but its hero, Ray, turns out to be too much of a good thing.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Mortals by Norman Rush. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Elegant Gathering of White Snows, a novel about eight women whose impromptu walking quest touches a nation, by Chris Radish. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, the co-founders of the band Fountains of Wayne. They have a new CD called Welcome Interstate Managers. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to